Welcome back to part two of the nuts and bolts of Minnesota appellate practice. As you can see, the background behind me has changed a little bit, and you can see the date was off to start with, but I'm recording this on the following day. In the last half, I talked a little bit about the perils of procrastination, how it's probably not a good idea because sometimes things can go wrong. Well, in this case, for some reason, after I changed the tape, the tape didn't want to record. So I'm re-recording the second half of the program. But we'll be moving on to actually filing the appeal and the mechanics, the nuts and bolts of actually filing the appeal with the Court of Appeals. Basically, the most important step, as mentioned before, and the only jurisdictional requirement is the filing of the notice of appeal with the district court administrator. The actual process is somewhat more involved. That document is the most important, but there are a few other requirements, albeit non-jurisdictional ones, that go along with that. In general, when the appeal is filed, you will be filing sets of documents to five different locations. You'll be filing them with the district or with the clerk of appellate courts, and I have them listed second, as you see in the materials. The reason, they're kind of the most important one, but the reason I mention them second is because I just wanted to add a reminder that some documents have to go to the district court administrator as well. In addition to the two courts, the district court and the Court of Appeals, you will be serving copies of all the documents on your opposing counsel, and you will also want copies for your client and also for your file. So just mechanically how I do this when I'm filing an appeal is I just prepare the cover letters listing each of the documents that go to each of those five places. And as I prepare a document, different people get different numbers of copies of and get different documents. So as I make a copy of the document and put it in the pile, I simply check it off that cover letter. And that, for me, serves as a good check to make sure that everybody is getting the right number of copies of the right documents and nothing is forgotten. Also, when you keep in mind that because those five important envelopes are all different, if you do mail them, you take them to the post office to have them weighed, keep in mind that they are all different weights. So you might run into trouble if the clerk simply weighs one of those envelopes and puts postage on all of them based upon that, because some are heavier than others. I think it's safe to say that the one to the clerk of appellate courts will take the most postage. So if you want to take that shortcut of only weighing one of them, weigh that one, since it will be the heaviest and you'll have sufficient postage on all of them. And again, what I like to do is just make a checklist on either the cover letter or an affidavit of service or both, and just use that as a checklist as I put documents in the right pile. So the process of starting the appeal involves sending documents to those five addresses, and now we'll cover which document goes to which address. And we will start with the Clerk of Appellate Courts. First of all, as we mentioned above, they get the Notice of Appeal, and that's the most important document in the case because that is the only jurisdictional document. And the Clerk of Appellate Courts gets two copies. The Notice of Appeal itself is actually a very perfunctory document. It will, even though it's extremely important, it will probably only take you 5 minutes to actually draft it, because it's actually quite simple. Because the main thing that the Notice of Appeal must contain is a statement specifying the judgment or order from which appeal is taken. So, again, if you look at the form 103A in the appendix of forms, you can just cut and paste from that. But the Notice of Appeal simply says, we appeal from the judgment entered on so-and-so date, or we appeal from the order filed on so-and-so date. So it simply must specify which order or judgment you're appealing from and state that you're appealing it. That document must also contain the names and addresses and phone numbers of you, the attorney for the appellant, and also the same information for the opposing counsel. And again, if you just copy it off of Rule Form 103A, that will give you all the information. Now, one thing, the rules specify that two copies are required. It's not really clear as to whether that's one original and one copy or two originals. Just to put any confusion aside, I just sign both of them so they can be treated either as originals or copies. I like to sign stuff like that in a blue pen to make clear that the person is looking at an original and not just a photocopy. But I just sign both of them. That way you're covered one way or another. And again, you can just paste that form from the court's website into your word processor, and actually preparing the notice of appeal will take you about 5 minutes. The second item that will go in that envelope to the clerk of appellate courts is, we talked about it earlier, one of those things that you had to order ahead of time was the certified copy of the judgment or order that's being appealed with the raised seal of the district court. That's the certified copy, and the original of that certified copy, if you will, that is the one with the raised seal, goes to the clerk of appellate courts. Next, you will also need two copies of a document entitled the Statement of the Case. Now, in some courts, there's a portion of the brief, really kind of the statement of facts, that is sometimes entitled the Statement of the Case. This is something a little bit different, so don't get those two things confused. This is, again, a form that you download from the court's website or from the back of your Minnesota Rules of Court book, and it's pretty much a fill-in-the-blank form, although it will require some thought, and we will be covering that that document in more detail in a little while. We'll kind of walk you through it. And that that tells a little bit about what the case is about. And it's mostly intended for the clerk's office to categorize the case and screen for conflicts and so forth. But we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Number four in the envelope to the clerk of appellate courts will be a check in the amount of $550. That's the filing fee. Now, that's one thing that's, I'm sure, bound to change. You're taking this course in 2011, and you might put these materials aside. As I mentioned before, you'll want to go through the rules and see if there have been any changes. I suspect that's one where there might be a change. The filing fee might have gone down, but more than likely it will have gone up. But checking the rules or a phone call to the clerk's office will ensure that you're enclosing the correct filing fee. The next item, number five, that has to go in that envelope to the clerk of appellate courts, we already talked about transcripts. If you have already ordered the transcript, or designated the transcript, you know, decided which portions that you're going to use, those documents regarding the transcript, the certificate signed by you and the court reporter, and any document designating what portions of the transcript you're going to be using, those would also be filed at this time. However, as we mentioned before, you have an additional 10 days to order that. So if you have not yet ordered the transcript, those can wait until that 10-day period. A copy of the bond I like to include. As we mentioned before, the cost bond, the original bond that you procured, the cost bond, that is filed with the district court administrator's office. That is filed with the trial court. It's not filed with the Court of Appeals. But generally, when I file the notice of appeal in that package of stuff that I send to the clerk of appellate courts, I include a copy of that bond. And just to avoid any confusion, if the blue pen, I write the word copy on the front page so that they know they're not accidentally getting the original. And I don't know if that's required, but it's not too much extra paper, so it doesn't seem to hurt. Finally, you will need a proof of service and proof of filing with the trial court. As opposing counsel will get copies of everything, as we'll talk about in a minute, the district court administrator will get some documents, and you just need an affidavit to the Court of Appeals saying that you did serve those documents on the opposing counsel, and also that you filed those two documents with the district court administrator. So that could be one affidavit or two, but that affidavit will be included. Incidentally, if you're hand delivering everything to the clerk's office, then you can just keep that affidavit blank, and then you can have it notarized right there at the clerk's office when you file everything else. So those are the seven things that go into the envelope to the district, or excuse me, to the clerk of appellate courts at the Minnesota Judicial Center. The next pile of papers on your table, and the next envelope that you'll have to send, will be going to the district court administrator. And the rules require that you send two things to the trial court administrator. One is a copy of the notice of appeal. That one does not have to be an original. It's one of the rare times that you file a copy of something with the trial court. Although, again, it certainly wouldn't hurt to put your original signature on there as well. And the other original document that they need is that cost bond, that bond in the amount of $500. Or if there was one of those rare cases where instead of getting the bond, you've got a written waiver of the bond, that waiver would be filed with the district court administrator. And again, not with the clerk of appellate courts. So that those are the you have those two envelopes taken care of the two courts that Steph is going to the Court of Appeals, the Clerk of Appellate Courts office, and also some documents to the District Court Administrator. Those other three piles are essentially just at least are one copy of all of those documents, and those other three piles will go to opposing counsel. To your client, and it's nice to show that you're doing work. So even if you think a particular document is not important, it's actually easier just to make a copy of everything rather than weed them out. And of course, a copy for your file. And those three piles, just for your convenience, I listed what those documents are: the notice of appeal, What I like to do, it's probably not required, but I include a copy of that certified copy. So I have the document with the raised seal, and I just make a regular copy of that and serve that on the other side. Again, it's probably not necessary, but just to make clear that everybody has a copy of everything in the record. The statement of the case, one copy of that, and again, that's that document we'll be talking about in a minute. If there are any of those, that certificate as to transcript or a designation of the transcript, a copy of that, a copy of the cost bond, and I always include a copy of the proof of service, the affidavit of service. Now, one little side note, I occasionally still get envelopes from opposing counsel, and if you look inside the envelope, and there's some document that they're serving upon me, and in that same envelope there is a signed and executed affidavit saying that I did, past tense, serve this document, and that document is the very thing that's in the envelope. And the affidavit says that they did mail it to me. So that doesn't quite make logical sense to me, although it seems to be a pretty widely accepted practice, but really not logically possible. I mean, they can't have mailed something to me and then I that the affidavit saying that they did mail it is right there in the same envelope. So I try to avoid that situation by giving them an unsigned copy of the affidavit of service. Well, as I mentioned, one of the documents that you're going to have to file along with the notice of appeal, and it's probably the single document that will take the most time for you to prepare. It's not particularly onerous, but it will take you a certain amount of time, is the statement of the case. This is found in Form 133. Again, from that appendix of forms. And this document in particular, it's quite helpful to download that, paste it into your word processor, because this form is largely a fill-in-the-blank form, and you'll save yourself a lot of typing by just downloading it. Just let me backtrack for one moment, because I have to give you the second code word. And one of the items that, remember, you are filing with the district court administrator is the bond, B-O-N-D, and that is our second code word. Bond is the second code word. Well, let's move on to the statement of the case. And again, in your materials here, I just did what I advise you to do. I cut and pasted from the court's website the statement of the case form. Most of the questions and answers here are pretty self-explanatory, but I will just, some of them require a little bit of explanation. So what I have done here is the underlined portions are my suggested answers or explanations of what you have to fill in on this form. And again, most of these questions are pretty easy, but some I'll give you a little bit of explanation. First of all, the court or agency from which the case originated, and along with the name of the judge. So again, the answer to question number one would simply be, District Court, 4th Judicial District, Anoka County, the Honorable John Smith, Judge of District Court, or something, whatever the case may be. Question number two is the jurisdictional statement. Now, as I mentioned before, the filing of the notice of appeal within that 60-day window is jurisdictional, and the court takes that very seriously, and the clerk's office and the staff attorneys screen all the incoming appeals to make sure that that it has been filed within that jurisdictional time limit. If you file it on day 61, they will catch it and it'll get dismissed. So you do have to watch that. And here is how they gather the information to make sure that that they catch any of those. This has some, you're not going to use, there are four subparts, 2, A, B, C, and D. For a civil appeal, you won't be using B and C, but we'll start by talking you through 2A, because that refers to appeals from a district court. Now, if it's some other kind of proceeding, some kind of administrative agency thing, then you would use one of those other two sections. First of all, an appeal from the district court, it asks you to identify the statute, rule, or other authority authorizing the appeal. And in virtually all cases, if it's an appeal from the district court, the answer to that question will be Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 103.01. Because the rules of civil appellate procedure, in addition to laying out the procedures, that particular rule is the rule that gives the Court of Appeals jurisdiction. Because Rule 103.01 says that the Court of Appeals has jurisdiction over appeals from the district court. So in virtually all civil appeals from the district court, the answer to that question is Rule 103.01. Not only do they have to have subject matter jurisdiction based upon what kind of case it is, but that timing is important, that 60-day rule. And the next part of this question is where they start identifying that information. Because they ask you for the date of entry of judgment or date of service of notice of filing of order from which appeal is taken. So if it's an appeal from a judgment, they want the date of entry of judgment. And you will find that on your certified copy, not the date that the clerk's office certified it, but the date on the last page of the order generally, where it says, the judgment is hereby entered on this so-and-so date. And that is the date that you would copy in. Typically, what the judgment winds up looking like in a lot of cases is there will be an order from the signed by the district judge, entitled Order for Judgment, and the last paragraph will say, judgment shall be entered accordingly, and he'll sign it, and then a couple days later, the clerk's office will add in something to the effect of, the above constitutes the judgment of the court. Judgment entered this so-and-so date, and that's the date that they're requesting here. And it's typically found on the last page of that certified copy that you obtained. The next question, that question asks, when did the clock begin to run? And the next question is, which clock are we using? How many days are allowed for this appeal? And in virtually every case, the answer to that question is 60 days are allowed. And the rule that sets that limit is Rule 104.01. So in most cases, the answer to this question will be Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 104.01. The next part of this question, date of filing of any motion that tolls the appeal time. There are not many, but there are a few motions where if you make that motion after judgment, it will stop the clock. It'll stop that 60-day clock during the pendency of that motion. So if there is one of those going on, and they are listed in, there aren't many of them, but they're listed in Rule 104.01 Subdivision 2. If there is one of those, you would say, this kind of motion was filed on this date, and we contend that that tolls that. Most cases the answer will be none, or NA or whatever, because generally that 60-day period is not tolled. But the next part of that question is, if it is tolled by the filing of that motion, the next part of the question is, at what time did the clock start running again, because of that motion being decided? So if it is one of these motions in Rule 104.01 sub 2 tolling it, the clock starts again when the district court decides that motion. So this question is asking, when does the clock start back up again? But if there was no such motion, again, the answer to this is simply none. Question B and question C, or part B and part C of this question, relate to certiorari appeals and other appellate proceedings. The scope of this CLE is civil cases from the district courts, but if you're involved in one of those other appellate proceedings, you would answer these questions instead of Part A. Part D you do answer because it asks about, is this a final judgment? Does it dispose of all claims by and against all parties, including the attorney's fees? So is this truly a final judgment against all parties? In most cases, this will be yes, because if you have one plaintiff versus one defendant, generally, once you have a final judgment, it's a final judgment. Where this might come into play, where you might know that it's not final, but still be allowed to proceed, is if you have multiple parties and there is a judgment, a final judgment against one party, but the case is continuing against some other parties. So, for example, you have the case of A versus B and C. You have Mr. A suing B and C, and one of those cases is there's a final judgment. There's a final judgment in the B case, but the C case is going to continue on to trial. So in that case, the issue would be whether B could appeal immediately or if he has to wait. And the answer to that is found in Rule 54.02 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, and that will give the specify the procedure when one party can appeal if there's a final judgment against that one party, but it's not a final judgment against all the parties. So if you did have a situation like that, the next part of the question is, did the district court follow that procedure from Rule 54.02 and Rule of Appellate Procedure 104.01? Basically, did the district court certify or sign off that that this one party can proceed with the appeal right now? And as it relates to that one party, this is a final judgment. That's, again, if you look at Rule 54.02 of the Civil Procedure Rules, you'll see that procedure. So if that was the case, then you would answer yes on here and ask you to provide the date of that order. Part E of this question, the next part, relates to criminal cases. Again, the scope of today's CLE is civil cases, although criminal cases are virtually the same procedure for most things. And here, in a criminal case, it asks whether the sentence has been imposed and whether or not it's been stayed. So you would answer that question in a criminal case. Well, now the next few questions turn kind of to the meat of the case, because for the first time you have to provide some substantive details about what the case is about, what the facts are about, what the legal issues are, what some of the legal arguments are going to be. Now, the audience when you're writing this document is generally the clerk's office. You're not really speaking to the judges who will be deciding your case at this point. Although there's certainly always the possibility that the three judges who are going to decide the case will be looking at this document. But keep in mind that your audience when you're writing this is generally the clerk's office and the staff attorneys. And they're going to use this information that you provide here to categorize the case, to tell what the case is about, possibly to screen for conflicts. Again, it's going to the court, and it will be part of the court file, and there's certainly a possibility that the judges actually deciding the case will read this. Certainly the other party will read it, and if you change abruptly in midstream, they might point it out. So even though the audience here is the clerk's office, you want to give some thought to what you're going to be saying in these sections of the statement of the case when you actually start talking about the meat of the case. What you say here isn't exactly carved into stone. There still might be, you'll be able to tweak it some, especially in the cases of when you identify the issues. If you identify five issues and then you just later decide, that the fourth and fifth issues, they're just not worth pursuing. We're gonna rest on the first three. You can certainly abandon issues, but you do want to give some thought to what it's going to be. And in fact, if you do this process properly, I think most of the time when you identify the issues here in the statement of the case, when it comes time to write the brief, you can just cut and paste those into your brief, probably with very minimal change. So you do want to, at this point, want to give some thought as to what the facts of the case, how you're going to present them, what the issues are, what some of the arguments are. Question number three is state the type of litigation and designate any statutes at issue. So you just want a very brief discussion, a brief description of what the case is. This is a contract case. This is a negligence case. This is a medical malpractice case. Just a very brief description, maybe one sentence talking about what the facts of the case are. And if there's any statute in issue, that statute should be identified. So just a very brief description of what the case is about. I might run out of time before I get to a piece that I have at the end. So when we're talking about statutes that are at issue in the case, I should point out that if your appeal calls into question the validity or the constitutionality of any state statute, and the state of Minnesota is not a party to the case, you are required to give notice to the Minnesota Attorney General, so that if the Attorney General wants to intervene in the case, since the validity of a statute has been called into question. The exact procedure, it's contained in the rules, and it's way at the end of the materials here. But since we're talking about statutes, and we could very well run out of time, I wanted to make sure that was pointed out, so that any time that you're questioning the validity of a statute and the state is not already a party to the case, you have to notify them. Now, in a criminal case, that would never come up, because in a criminal case, the state is already a party. But if it's a private dispute between two parties, and one of them is saying that the statute is valid, and the other one is saying the statute is invalid, well, the Attorney General has the right to intervene in that appeal, since it's calling into question the validity of the statute. And for them to be able to do that, they have to know that the case is going on. And the parties to the appeal are the ones who are obligated to make that notice. And again, the exact rule is cited at, near the end of the materials. Question number four is kind of a continuation of that. A brief description of the claims, defenses, and issues litigated below and the result below. So again, just a brief description of the case, and on all of these, you want to present it fairly, you want to present it neutrally, but on the other hand, you don't want to give away the store. So I mean, there's a little bit of a fine line when you're writing stuff like this, that you want to present it objectively, there's, in the choice of language you use, there's always the opportunity to put your client's particular spin on it a little bit. So don't, when you're busy being trying to be very objective and very neutral as you write these, don't necessarily give away the store. You can still be an advocate for your client's position. Now, question number five is where we really kind of get into the meat of it, because question five is list the specific issues that you propose to raise on this appeal. And again, this is really the first time that you, in the case of the course of your appeal, that you have to identify what reason that you have for reversing the judgment below. Again, these issues that you identify right now are not necessarily carved into stone. You can change the wording a little bit, or you can abandon issues that you decide that you don't want to pursue after all. This is the time where you do have to, for the first time, kind of put up and say, here are the issues in the case. Here is why we think the case should be reversed. And once again, the issue should be presented neutrally. You should not do it in an argumentative fashion. But on the other hand, it usually doesn't hurt to do it in such a way where it suggests, the way you ask the question kind of suggests what you believe to be the correct answer. So in other words, making it a little bit of a leading question doesn't necessarily hurt. But you should also do it objectively. Question number six, if you are aware of any related appeals, this is where you would identify them. There could be two different kinds of related appeals. First of all, another appeal that you're aware of that arises from the same case. So, for example, if there are two defendants and you are appealing and that you are aware that the other defendant has already appealed, then if you're aware of it, you should identify that other appeal here. You're probably going to know about those, maybe not though if you file them the same day, but it's just if you're aware of them, you should identify them. The second category you might not be aware of, it's probably less likely that you'll be aware of, but if you are aware of any, and here they even say any known pending appeals, in some other action that addresses or that raises similar issues or the same issue, you should identify them here. And it's pretty unlikely that that you're going to know about that to be able to identify it. But if you have a case and that you are aware that last month somebody filed an appeal with the exact same issue and an appeal from St. Louis County, you should identify that so that the court is aware that there are these two cases working their way through the system that address similar issues. Again, though, it's unlikely that that you will be aware of that. But if you are, you should identify them. But otherwise, you just answer none. Question number seven, and we talked about transcript previously. So here you have to identify whether you think a transcript is necessary. And again, in many cases, no is a perfectly acceptable answer to this question, because there are some cases where you do not need a transcript. You know, if it's just a summary judgment motion and there was no testimony taken at trial or in the district court, there was no hearing with testimony taken, you probably don't need a transcript. I mean, you might. I wouldn't say definitely not. But don't think that just because you're appealing that you need a transcript of something, because you don't necessarily. If the trial court's decision was based entirely on documentary evidence and there was no testimony of any kind, there's really probably no need for a transcript in that case. But here is where you identify whether or not you think that a transcript is necessary. The next part of the question, if a transcript is required, if you think it is required, should that be a full or a partial transcript? I think probably in most cases it's going to be partial, or it could be partial to some extent. So if you, you know, again, if you have the transcript of the three-day trial, you might not need the transcript of the motion in limine that took place a couple of weeks before a trial. So in many cases, even if you want a transcript, it might wind up being a partial transcript. So here, you would identify that you think just a partial transcript. And again, when you file either now or within 10 days, those documents regarding the transcript, that's where you would designate what portions of the transcript that you want. You would say, we need the testimony on February 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, but we do not need that motion that took place back in December, for example. You will be making that identification in 10 days. Arguments of the attorneys, you probably don't need to have transcribed unless there's some special good reason to doing it. One is you know, if the substantive law in your case says that if a party takes one theory of the case at trial, they have to stick with that theory of the case. Well, then maybe you do want transcript of the arguments so that the court can see what theory of the case was being used before. But again, the arguments of the attorneys are not evidence, so they're really not absolutely necessary, and you could very well not need to order transcripts of those. Next question, has the transcript already been delivered to the parties and filed with the trial court administrator? So is the transcript completely done? And usually the answer to that one will be no, it's not complete yet. You might have ordered it, but you know, and maybe if it's a short transcript, it has already been delivered, and you can check that yes, the transcript is all finished. But if you have just recently ordered the transcript, or if you have not yet ordered it and plan to do so in the next 10 days, the answer to that question will be no, that the transcript is not done yet. But the next question, but has it been ordered yet? If you ordered it previously or at the same time as the notice of appeal, you would check yes. But again, if you're going to take advantage of that extra 10 days that you have to order the transcript, the answer to this question would be no. Now, the next part of this question refers to these alternate methods of having a transcript under Rule 110.03 and 110.01. There are two procedures in there. One is for the attorneys to just sit down and make a stipulation as to this is what the testimony was at trial. And in lieu of a transcript, their stipulation can take the place of the transcript. I've never seen that done, but it is a possibility. And especially in a case where, you know, maybe the facts are not too controversial. But maybe there is some testimony anyway. The other one is for kind of a rare situation where the transcript is unavailable. So either maybe it was a hearing for some reason, there was no court reporter there, or the notes were lost or something. This rule provides a mechanism for the trial court to recreate the transcript where none exists, basically. So if you use either of those procedures, then you would check yes on there, but I never have. I really never heard of them ever being used. So most of the time, the answer to that last part of the question would be no. Question number 8, is oral argument requested? I always check yes. Oral argument, I think is important, because if you have one judge who's kind of on the fence, and you think can be swayed, or that's your one last chance to go into court and make the case. Now you're not going to have the case decided based upon your eloquent speech that you make at the oral argument, because the court, the judges read the briefs, their clerks read the briefs. Long before the argument. And in general, each judge in his or her mind has made up their mind as to how they're going to decide the case most of the time, based upon the brief and the written materials. Oral argument very rarely makes a difference. Although if one judge is on the fence, you know, what happens? An oral argument might be enough to tip the scales. Sometimes what happens at oral argument is, one judge up there will try to persuade the other judge by asking you some friendly questions to sway the other judge. So I always check yes, we want oral argument. And besides that, that adds a little bit of... it makes the process seem a little bit more like going to court. If there weren't oral arguments, the judges wouldn't need robes or anything. They could just sit in their offices and read these briefs. So if you're going to go to court, you may as well actually go to court. So I always check yes. If so, next question, is argument requested at a location other than provided in Rule 134.09? Well, I haven't read, I don't remember exactly what Rule 134.09 says, but in general, every oral argument I've been to has been at the Judicial Center in St. Paul. I think what the rule is something to the effect of that if the case arises in anywhere in the metro area, you know, and maybe even stretching out a little bit from there, you know, Hennepin County, Washington County, Dakota County, maybe Chisago, Sandy, you know, those metro area counties, generally they will be held in St. Paul. But if the case is from Rock County, perhaps it will be in the southwestern part of the state. I've never had occasion to actually look at the rule because I don't care where court is held, and I'm not going to argue with the court where they want to do it. But I think there is an option for argument to be held in the judicial district, not necessarily the same county, but at least within the same district where the case arises. But I always just check, no, I'm perfectly happy going to oral argument wherever the court wants to. If they have a good reason to have the case heard in some particular place. I'm certainly not going to argue with them about that. I just want them to decide the case. I don't care where they decide the case. But the next part of the question is, if yes, state where oral argument is requested. So if you, if you have a case here in the Twin Cities and you, for whatever reason, maybe you like the architecture of the Rock County Courthouse, this is the place where you would say, I want to have oral argument held in Laverne, Minnesota. I doubt if that would be very successful, but at least that is where you would make that request. Question number 9 is, identify the type of brief to be filed. I always check the box that says formal brief. There are these two other procedures, and I've never seen them used, but there is a procedure where you can request to have an informal brief. Or you can even request to just recycle the arguments you made in the trial court, perhaps with an extra little letter, and just have the court read those submissions without reading your brief. I've never done that. I've never seen it done. And really, I don't see any advantage to doing it. The one advantage I can see to it is that if you are not familiar with the procedures and you don't know how to do a formal brief, perhaps you want to go the informal route. But you have taken this course, and you know exactly how to put together, when you're done, you will know exactly how to put together a formal brief. You will realize that it's not a daunting task at all, and you will also, the opposing counsel might find it daunting. So having taken this course, you will have an unfair advantage, almost, if you select a formal brief, because it will be a breeze for you, but it might stress out your opposing counsel. So definitely check the box that says you want a formal brief, because they're not that difficult. Finally, question 10, it calls for your name, address, zip code, phone number, and attorney ID number, and the same information for the other attorneys in the case. So you need to identify all of the lawyers, or of the pro se person. Finally, you sign it. So you just cut and paste the signature block with your name and address and attorney ID number and phone number and everything that you use in all of your pleadings, and paste that in there and sign it. And of course, don't forget to include the date on the signature page. So again, that is the one document that you will file along with the notice of appeal that will take a little bit of your time. It'll take you, an hour or so to sit down and write this. But it's not particularly daunting. But that's the one document that will, in the preparing of these preliminary documents along with the notice of appeal, that's the one that'll probably take the most time and requires the most thought. But I think you see that filing those documents is actually quite simple, and it's almost a perfunctory process of getting the appellate ball rolling. But that brings us to the next step. And that is filing the brief, and that, as you're aware, will take some work, and it's definitely not a perfunctory step. It will take, that's where you want to put your thought and really put your work into it. Which brings us to our third and final code word for our podcast viewers. And the third code word is brief. B-R-I-E-F, brief, which is really the most important document in the case. Now, if you've ever practiced in any other appellate courts, many of them will send you out a briefing schedule. So what you will do is you'll file the notice of appeal, maybe just in the nick of time, and you just, a relief that you get that thing in there, and then you sit back and you relax and you wait for the court to send you a briefing schedule. And in that briefing schedule, the court will tell you when your brief is due. and you can kind of sit back until you get that briefing schedule and safe in the knowledge that you don't have anything to do until that schedule shows up in your mailbox. Well, if that's the way things work in some other courts, but that is not the way it works in Minnesota. Minnesota does not have a briefing schedule. You are responsible for calculating when the brief is due, and you are responsible for getting it in time. So, do not wait for a briefing schedule to come to the court from the court, because it will never come. You have to decide when the brief is due. You have to look in the rules, and it's easy to figure out, but you won't hear very much from the court. I think you get a notice of filing that will give you the court file number for the case, but you won't get very much correspondence from the court, and you definitely will not get a briefing schedule. You have to calculate when that is due. And the brief may be due in as little as 30 days after filing the notice of appeal, because the time for the brief is set in Rule 131.01, and it says 30 days from the later of either the date you filed the notice of appeal or the date that the transcript is finished. So if there is no transcript, either because you decided you don't need a transcript or because the transcript was all prepared prior to the appeal, in that case, when you're not waiting on the transcript, then the brief is due 30 days after the notice of appeal. Now, you know, when you're counting days under these rules, a lot of times you always think, oh, but I always have an extra 3 days for mailing. Well, no, you don't here, because you didn't mail the notice of appeal to yourself. You might have mailed it to other people, but you're the one who set that date by mailing it, or by filing the notice of appeal. So you don't get an extra 3 days because you mailed it. The brief is due 30 days after the notice of appeal. If there is a transcript, then you have 30 days from the date that the transcript was delivered to the Court of Appeals. In that case, you might get that extra 3 days if the court reporter mailed the transcript. But don't count on that, because you know, especially if the transcript is bulky, the court reporter might have hand-delivered it to the court. You know, might be a lot easier than mailing it. So you might have 33 days, but probably just 30 days after the transcript is delivered to the Court of Appeals. But you will not get a briefing schedule from the court. You will not get reminders that your brief is due next week. You are responsible for getting it in time. And in time is generally 30 days from the notice of appeal or from any later transcript being delivered. So that means if there's no transcript, you have to get to work right away. And it also means that if there's a transcript, you need to get to work as soon as you get the transcript. And you were there at trial. Don't wait for the transcript to even start. You were there. You kind of remember what happened. So you can start writing the brief and then fill in citations to what page on the transcript things were. And if your memory is like mine, you'll always, when you read that transcript, you will have remembered a few things incorrectly. But chances are you have a pretty good recollection of what was said, and you can write the brief without having the transcript in hand. But the brief is due 30 days after the transcript is received. Now, what happens if you are late? Well, the court takes that very seriously. And yes, someone sits around the clerk's office looking at briefs when they come in and comparing the dates of that brief with the date of the notice of appeal or the transcript. And they do catch it. They've never caught me, but in some cases the opposing counsel, they were probably waiting for a briefing schedule that never came. And What will happen, the sanction for getting your brief in late, you will get an order, and the order will first of all give you the drop-dead new due date, which will only be a couple of weeks. So if you're waiting for that briefing order, that was a bad thing to do, because when you do get the briefing schedule, you're already in trouble and you won't have very much time left. But they will give the date that the brief is now really due, or there will be serious consequences. And what the consequence will be at that point will be that oral argument will be canceled. There will not be oral argument in the case in which one of the parties got their brief in late. Now, in that particular case, I was a little bit put aback, because I was looking forward to oral argument in that case, and here the other side, because I knew they were going to stammer their way through it and look bad, and I was going to look good, and they got oral argument stricken from the calendar because they did not get their brief in on time. So in that case, I think it was a little bit to their advantage almost, but I took solace in the fact that there's this order, right on top of the court's file that the judges are going to see, and the judges who are reading these briefs, wondering why they do not have the opportunity to question the attorneys, they will see in that order that it's the other guy's fault, that the in that case they were the appellant and they didn't get their brief in on time. So I took solace from the fact that that order clearly identified them as the culprits in having the oral argument canceled. So you don't want the judges, the judges deciding your case to see that you screwed up and didn't get the brief in time. And that fact will be very prominently displayed in the file. So you don't want that to happen. So you get your brief in on time. The opening brief, the appellant's brief, the brief of the blue cover, and we'll talk about the covers in a minute, due 30 days after the notice of appeal or the transcript. Then the respondent has an additional 30 days to file their brief, and that one has a red cover, by the way. And if there is a reply brief, if the appellant wants to respond to arguments raised in the respondent's brief, they have an additional 10 days to get that in. And that, incidentally, has a gray cover. We'll get to those color covers in a minute. But get your briefs in on time and do not wait for a briefing schedule, because the only briefing schedule you see will be the one that that says you're in trouble. Well, how many copies of the brief do you need? In Minnesota, you need, for the Court of Appeals, you need 7 copies, and one of those 7 should be unbound. So in other words, there are 6 bound copies, and we'll talk about binding in a minute, and one should be unbound. And what I do on that unbound one is I have the cardboard cover that normally goes with it, the cardboard cover that goes on the back. And I just put them, instead of binding them, I just put a rubber band around it. Now, the question always arises, in my mind, maybe I think too much through these things, but, which of those 7 am I supposed to sign? Am I supposed to sign one of the bound ones, or am I supposed to sign that unbound one? In other words, which one is the original? And when I asked the clerk's office about that, I forget what their answer was, but it was kind of like they didn't really care too much. But just to cover my bases, I feel better if I just sign all 7 of them. All 7 of them have my original signature in blue ink. So if they want to treat one of them as an original, then it's an original, because it has my original signature. In addition to those 7, you will need 2 copies for each opposing party, or each opposing counsel, or more correctly, each party separately represented. So in a case where one plaintiff versus one defendant, you'll need 2 copies, but if there are two opposing parties with different attorneys, you would need 2 copies for each of those attorneys. But in a normal case of one plaintiff and one defendant, you need 2 copies for the opposing lawyer, You need one copy at least for yourself and one copy for your client. And they don't cost that much. You know, it's, the binding is $2 or something. So when you're finished, you have this nice book. So, you know, you just wrote a book on behalf of your client. So send them a copy of the book. Don't just copy the pages and staple them together or something. You wrote a book, you may as well send them a copy of the book. So you'll need, when you go to FedEx office or UPS store or whatever, you'll need a total of 11 copies, and you'll need to get 10 of those bound. Now, writing the brief. We have, looks like, about 14 minutes left, and we're not going to give you in 14 minutes a lot of background in legal writing and persuasion, and that wasn't the purpose of this course. But again, we're just going to talk you through the nuts and bolts of what has to go in that brief. But suffice it to say that that's a very important document. That's the most important document in the case. The judges will read it. Whatever you say in there has the opportunity to sway them. Whatever you don't say in your brief will not have that opportunity. So you can't save things for oral argument. That just will not work because it has to be in the brief. The requirements for what has to go in the brief, the substantive requirements of what the contents have to be, are in Rule 128 and Form 128. So the best way to do it, what I like to do when I sit down to start writing it, is you just take that Form 128, paste it into my word processor. Obviously, Form 128 is only, you know, one page long or something, or a couple pages long. It doesn't take up much space, but it serves as kind of a nice checklist of, you know, make sure that you don't forget anything. It'll remind you that you need the cover and the table of contents and the table of authorities, and it'll list all of those elements that have to go in the brief. Now, many of those are obviously not written until after the bulk of the brief is done. So, for example, the table of contents comes first, but you can't write the table of contents until you've written the contents. But what I like to do to make sure that I don't forget anything like that is, in the document as I'm writing it, I just leave a blank page and say the table of contents goes here. And then when I've finished writing the rest of the brief, then that serves as a reminder to me so I can go in and add the table of contents. Or if you want to write the statement of facts last, you know, at least you'll have it in the template. You know, the statement of facts goes here, so that you don't, in your haste, you don't forget to include that. But anyway, that checklist is found in Rule 128. Okay, we are back with part three of the nuts and bolts of Minnesota appellate practice. And we are talking about writing the brief, the contents from Form 128, and what has to be in the brief. And the next portion of the materials is just kind of a checklist, and I'll go through that and cover what. Most of them are pretty self-explanatory, but a few require some comments. First of all, cover. Again, you can just cut and paste from Form 128, but it just has the name of the case and says it's the appellant's brief or whatever, and the information from your case. Table of contents, pretty self-explanatory, and the table of authorities. Again, just follow the template that's given in that Form 128. The easiest way that I've found to do that is you save that for last. After you've written the rest of the brief, I just go through and cut and paste the citations to any cases or statutes or other authorities, law review articles, and just cut and paste that that citation into the table of authorities, put it in alphabetical order. Usually, you know, the case is in alphabetical order, then the statute's in order, then the law review article's in order. And then you need to show each page where that case is cited. So if the case of Smith v. Jones is cited on page 12, 18, and 27, you'll have the citation for Smith v. Jones, and then indicating what pages that that's cited on. Then the meat of the brief generally starts on the next page with the legal issues. And what the rule calls for is a precise statement of each legal issue, including what the trial court held. Now, here, if you did your statement of the case right, you already have those written, and you should be able to pretty much just cut and paste those, maybe with a little bit of tweaking and a little bit of editing. And here, you want to again state the issues fairly, but you want them to kind of suggest the correct answer. But on the other hand, the court cleverly has this rule that where you have to say what the trial court's holding was right there. So that kind of checks your ability to ask leading questions just a little bit, because it might look kind of silly. Did the trial court commit an egregious error? And the trial court held no. Seems kind of obvious. You want to state the issues fairly, but sometimes you can work a little bit of advocacy into the way that you word the questions so that they perhaps suggest what you believe to be the correct answer. Next comes the statement of the facts. And again, you have to state the facts fairly. You have to be objective. The substantive law will tell you a little bit about how you have to word them. You know, you might have to word them most favorably to the non-moving party or something like that. But the facts, you do not want to state them argumentatively. Although, by your use of language, you want to be somewhat compelling and make it tell it from your client's perspective to some extent. Most importantly, though, everything that you state in the statement of facts has to have some citation to the record. So you have to say where in the record that you can find that fact. So that might be a citation to the transcript, or it might be a citation to the appendix to your brief, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. I might say what page on the appendix you can find that fact. It might be some document that you didn't specifically include in the record. So occasionally it'll be, you know, see page 32 of so-and-so affidavit that was filed on this date. And again, keep in mind that the court always has the entire district court file in front of them, so they can easily find those if you cite them that way. I usually include the first time, I include abbreviations for where in the record things are. So like on page 82 of the transcript will be T period 82. And the first time I do that, I put a footnote just pointing out what that stands for. And usually if I'm citing to something in the appendix, on page 15 of the appendix, I'll do the citation as A15. And again, just put a footnote the first time you do that so that they're aware of what your abbreviation scheme is. But it's usually pretty self-explanatory. Moving on then to the argument section. Previously, you identified the issues in the case. Well, each one of those issues will become a subheading of the argument. It will become one of the Roman numerals of the argument. But instead of being phrased in the form of a question, it will be phrased in the form of an answer to that question. So in the statement of issues, the first issue might be, did the trial court err in granting summary judgment because, well, in the argument section, that becomes the trial court erred in granting summary judgment because. And then after each of those Roman numeral headings, you launch into your argument. And that's your chance to sway the judges and talk them into reversing or affirming, whichever you want them to do. Now, some states require a separate section of the brief covering the standard of review. In Minnesota, you are to include that in the argument section. It doesn't say specifically that it's the very first thing that you say, but it should probably be near the top, because the judges are always very sensitive to what the standard of review is, and they will be looking for that. Now, the standard review, sometimes attorneys kind of put that in as an afterthought. You know, they know they're required to say it, so they'll just, find the first case they can find that says what the standard review is, and then they'll put that in. Give some thought to how you're going to word that. And I almost always put the standard review in the form of a quotation from an earlier case, because as you're doing the research for your case, virtually every one of those cases that you look at will also be talking about the standard of review. And it pays to shop around in the language, and specifically it pays to find a case where the party in your guy's position won. So for example, if you are representing the appellant and you want it reversed, take the standard of review out of a case where it gets reversed. And the reason for that is because some of these standards of review are going to be deferential to the other side. There are some that might be deferential to you, there might be some that would be deferential to the other side. But whichever way it is, you can always word it in such a way that it's a little bit more favorable to your guy. And by quoting that from an earlier case where your guy won, that's a very fair way of doing that, I think. So for example, if the standard of review is abuse of discretion, well, there are two ways of stating that. One is to say that the lower court can only be reversed if it was a clear abuse of discretion. The lower court must not be reversed in the absence of an abuse of discretion, or something like that. That's one way of wording it. Well, but there's also another way of wording it. Glass half full, glass half empty. The other way of wording that is that the Court of Appeals must reverse if there has been a clear showing of abuse of discretion. So shop around and find the case that states that standard of review in the light most favorable to your guy, even if the standard of review does not start out being very deferential to your side. Finally, the conclusion. And the rule says a statement of the precise relief sought. So you have to say what you're asking for. There has to be a prayer for relief. You don't just say, therefore we respectfully submit that the district court erred. You have to tell the court what you want them to do. So you say, we respectfully submit the trial court erred. Therefore, we submit that the case must be reversed and remanded, or that the case must be affirmed, or ask what you're asking for and be specific about it. Now, not all attorneys do this, but I like to use the conclusion as one last opportunity to kind of restate the argument. So if there were three issues, I might include three sentences before I get to the very, very end of the conclusion. So I might say, because the trial court failed to consider this testimony, and because the trial court improperly granted this motion, it just kind of say the reasons one more time. But what is most important there is to say what you're actually asking for. That might be a stylistic kind of thing, including the one last summary of the argument, but what you definitely want to include is a statement of the precise relief sought. Say, we are asking for this to be reversed or to be remanded. Then you need your signature. Again, I just sign all seven of them. and I usually just put respectfully submitted, comma, and then my normal signature line, name, address, attorney ID number, phone number, etc., and then a description of who I am, such as attorney for plaintiff appellant, or something to that effect. Finally, there is an appendix, it's the appendix in the rules that talk about two ways, but that at the back of your brief, you have the opportunity to make copies of some of the documents from the case. But please don't overdo that, because you don't want to wind up with a brief that looks like the Tokyo phone book, because you included 1,000 pages of documents at the back. Remember, the judges have access to the original district court file, and they are able to consult that whenever they want. So if you want them to look at page 52 of some document, they can go find it. Generally, what you should have in that appendix is what's required, first of all, and just any really good stuff that really helps your side that you want the judge to have handy when he's reading your brief. He can flip right to that document and see what it says. If it's not that kind of thing where you want every reader of your brief to be able to read that, then don't include it. But what's required is the documents identified as the addendum, and that's basically the copy of the judgment or order being appealed from. That same thing that you got the certified copy of, that has to go in the addendum. But any other documents that you think are helpful, but only put them in there if you're helpful. Don't flood the court with paper. They already have plenty of paper. Only put in your brief things that you want them to actually read. If you don't want them to actually read it, if you don't want every person reading your brief to be able to read those documents, then don't include them. A short one is always better than a long one. But don't go overboard. That will also have an index of your appendix, all the documents that are listed in there. So at the beginning of your appendix, we'll just say appendix and its index, and you'll list the documents that are in there. The first one is the order being appealed from, and maybe any of those smoking gun documents that you want to include, and indicate what page they are. And the appendix should be separately paged, starting with page A1, then page A2, A3, etc. Page limits. How long can the brief be? The brief can be 45 pages. You basically start counting the pages at the issues section up through the conclusion. So the cover doesn't count, the table of contents doesn't count, the table of authorities doesn't count, and the appendix doesn't count. But pretty much everything in between there counts for pages. And you are allowed up to 45 pages. Now, there's an alternative method based upon the number of lines or the number of words. So you, in theory, could have a 47-page brief, and it would be perfectly legal if you used one of these alternate methods. And if you use one of those alternate methods, you have to include a certificate saying how many words there are or how many lines there are. And that's covered in Rule 132.01. But I would strongly discourage you from ever bothering with that procedure, because unless it's just an extremely, extremely complex case, there's really no reason to have more than 45 pages. You should have less than 45 pages. So don't try to worry about how you can get more than 45 pages. Keep it under 45 pages unless there's some extremely compelling reason. Because, again, you want the judges to read the thing. And if you ask them to read a book that's more than 45 pages long, they're probably going to doze off by the time they get to the end. So you want to keep it short and put only good stuff in your brief. Don't try to figure out how you can make it a little bit longer by counting words and counting pages. But if you do follow either of those procedures, you have to include that certificate. but keep it short. Finally, before you print out your manuscript, take a look at Rule 132.01, and that will make sure that you have the correct font size and margins and all of that. Printing and binding the brief is a pretty easy proposition. I am running out of time here, but I've included some materials on what you need to do that. It's quite easy to do it yourself by taking it to FedEx office or to UPS store or to any other copy place. You'll need copies of it made. You will need covers printed, and you'll need to have it bound. And I have a link here to the court's website of what the approved binding methods are. But the easiest to find and the easiest to use and quite frequently used method is called VeloBind. So when you go into Kinko's or wherever and you ask them to do a VeloBind, they will know exactly what that is, and it will meet the court's requirements. On questions like that, again, if you ever have any questions, you call the clerk's office. They'll be more than happy to help you out. Minnesota does not allow spiral binding, although some courts, the Fifth Circuit, for example, that was pretty much the only kind that they would accept. But the Minnesota courts, that's the one that they definitely will not accept. So they're sometimes kind of picky on these binding methods. But velo binding is one. Perfect binding is another. Oral argument, we don't have a lot of time to cover, but as I've mentioned before, you're not going to win or lose the case based upon that. You're going to win or lose the case based upon what's in your brief. But it might be an opportunity to sway somebody who's on the fence. You're not going to have an opportunity to go in there and make a speech. What I do is write down the 5 or 6 points that I think I want to make, that I want to try to make. And when I get up there to talk, I will start talking about that first one. But more often than not, I'll get interrupted by a question before I even get that first point out. But if I put some thought into what I want to say, chances are one of the things I want to say is an answer to that question that I'm getting from the court. After I answer that question, I cross that off my list, and maybe there's another question. And of those 5 or 6 items that I have on there, maybe they asked questions and I gave the answers, which were items 2 and 4 on my list. Well, if that's the case, if I still do have additional time, then I start at the top of the list and try to get in the point that I thought was most important. You're not going to be able to get in all 5 or 6 of those points because you only have about 10 minutes to talk. There are lights in front of your podium, green, yellow, and red. The green one comes on when you stand up. The yellow one comes on very fast, and it warns you that you only have 1 minute left. When the red light comes on, you finish your sentence, you say thank you, and you sit down. There are other cases, they don't have time to listen to the one thing that you forgot to say, because that should have been in your brief. They will be able to see that. There's metered parking across the street from the Judicial Center on the south side of the building across the street. I think they take quarters or maybe credit cards, so bring a lot of quarters with you. And get there before the first case of the day, in case they call cases out of order, and just so you can kind of see what's going on. And, you know, it doesn't hurt to take in a session on another day, just to kind of familiarize yourself with the procedure. Costs. The prevailing party can submit a bill of costs and get their costs from the other side. That's generally the cost of printing the brief, the cost of the transcript and the filing fee, and maybe some other things. You generally don't get attorney's fees, but the one case I have here cited, the Bucko case, if you got attorney's fees below, the other side appealed, and you prevailed, then you will get your attorney's fees on the appeal, because that was part of that same procedure where you got them in the district court. Finally, I have a cite here for the rule that I mentioned previously. Rule 144 for notifying the Attorney General if the validity of a statute is in question. And finally, as I mentioned previously, the sample letter of the court reporter. Well, I hope today's program proves helpful to you. Again, I think it will give you that familiarity so that when these issues come up, because when you're confronted with an appeal, it might be a rather sudden experience. You didn't necessarily expect to be doing it. But I hope this gives you the basic familiarity that you'll be able to avoid some pitfalls. You'll know where to find the information, and I think you will have a successful experience in the Court of Appeals. So thank you very much.